is this great weather or what? I mean, it was actually cold Thursday morning, which just, you know, it just makes you feel alive. But then you get those cool mornings outside, the bright sunshine, that blue Carolina sky, and you got the leaves turning to colors. Just a great time of the year. I hope you've been outside today. I was outside a little early this morning, a little bit later on this morning, and I'm going to be outside a lot this evening, so hope you got a chance to get outside, even if it's just in your own backyard. My name is Roger Metz, and you're listening to another live edition of Woods and Water South Carolina. You can tune in right there on your FM dial at 94.5. If you can't get that signal, then you can download the free Conservative Talk 94.5 WGTK app, or go to the station website, click the Listen Live link on the right side of the page. That website, conservativetalk945.com. You can also find this show on Facebook, Instagram, and this week I'm going to be adding a lot of things to the website, mainly podcasts, because I do have the directions to get the podcasts up. So that is woodsandwatersc.com. And again, thanks to the folks down at Outdoor Underwriters for making that website a whole lot easier to use and a whole lot easier to view. I'm that good kind of sore today. I took a carload of seniors on a hike up at DuPont State Forest yesterday. I'd say the leaves are just about peak, maybe past for a few trees, but others are just getting there. This weekend, are probably the best colors, if I had to make a guess. However, be prepared for the crowds. It was crowded up there yesterday for a Friday. Pretty place, few people there, but boy, once we got to DuPont, those parking lots were packed. So just remember, be courteous. Please pick up after yourself. Nothing like seeing trash laying along the trail. Anyway, we parked down at the Hooker Falls parking lot, ate lunch on the picnic tables, hiked up the trail, the Triple Falls, and then up to the pools at the bottom of Upper Falls. Didn't quite make it all the way to the covered bridge there. But if you don't know, you know, there are picnic tables up there. If you go downstream towards Hooker Falls, they're on the right. There's three of them there. If you want to hike a little bit and then eat lunch, there are picnic shelters up there to the right of the trail at Triple Falls. There's a big picnic shelter there. I believe there's one on Upper Falls, somewhere close there. Just remember, it's cool. Dress in layers. Wear good shoes. The trails are in great shape. And I don't think sandals are really the right shoes to hike in, but I saw plenty of them yesterday. Talked to a few guys trout fishing, and they had caught some. Schedule says that North Carolina stocked those streams the first week in October and due to stock them again the first week of November. I checked. South Carolina stocked parts of the Chattooga River and the South Saluda last week. Remember, most of those streams are back under delayed harvest regulations, so check before you go, just to make sure you're on the right side of Mr. Green Jeans. I actually hiked yesterday, got in a few hours of deer hunting this week and a couple of mornings. Saw a couple of does with their yearlings and one little spike. I caught a glimpse of a nice big-bodied deer in the pine trees, but you know, couldn't see the head, couldn't see much of the back, and that just means my imagination now has me missing a chance at a new state record deer. So, but I've watched those does raise those fawns this year at the farm. So unlike our topic today, the coyotes have not taken out 70% of the yearlings this spring or summer. Like I told you last week, today we have a taped conversation with Dr. John Kilgo from the USDA down at Savannah River site in Aiken. We talked the whole conversation is 31 minutes long. And we're going to break it up over three segments today's show. But I wanted you to hear the details behind the study that John has done. And he started those studies back in 2006. So you can hear both the technology they used and the effort they put into getting what I think are pretty much unarguable results, at least as far as the 78,000 acres of the Savannah Riverside go. It's different parts of the state. Coyote concentrations are different. But just listen to the whole show. A lot of information, and this applies. I mean, it's mostly geared towards the deer hunters out there in our deer population, but it, you know, coyotes are going to affect all of us. They're going to affect the rabbit populations, the fox populations, well, your little outside dog or cat. But it's something you need to be aware of because, like he says in the interview, and you'll hear it, the coyotes are here to stay. If you were listening last week, I appreciate you tuning in again this week. I had a little meltdown. It was a Royal Chinese fire drill on both sides of the glass here. But what was really funny was Dave was here, and then Angelo showed up too. He having heard the problems while he was driving down 385. You know, I got done, walked out into the hall outside. Instead of getting any sympathy, I got, welcome to the world of live broadcast radio. So, thanks for hanging in there with me, my guests, Chris and Reagan, and then Ryan Bass with DNR. I appreciate y'all being with me last week, putting up with our problems. And, you know, hey, the phones can crash all day today. We don't need them. So let's get to a few items on the calendar event. If you're looking for something to do this evening, Croft State Park, Niwala Weekend. It's just Halloween fun at Croft State Park with activities for all. Hot dogs, nachos, popcorns, drinks, ghost stories, bonfire, marshmallow roasting. Probably have some s'mores there. If not, you might want to take your own. Hot chocolate, park admission, $2 adult, $1.25 for seniors. Balloons, face painting, golf carts, magic shows, trick-or-treating, and then spooky hay rides for $2 a person. So, like the South Carolina State Park website says, come out and play. We've talked a little bit about Denver Downs calendar events. They've got a lot going on. Don't forget, this weekend is the Civil War Living History and Reenactment Weekend. It's today and tomorrow. Let's see, that's Sunday. Thursday, October 30th, Boy and Girl Scout Night. A flashlight maze, Friday the 31st, a Halloween dance party, costume contest, bonfire, flashlight maze, love it. November the 1st, Grandparents' Day, one grandparent admission free with purchase of child, very nice. Flashlight maze, live music at the bonfire, Dog Day, November the 1st, and all day is the pumpkin busting day. So that's Denver Downs Farms down in Anderson. Go to their website, check it out. Ducks Unlimited. The Easley Ducks Unlimited dinner will be Tuesday, October the 28th, 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock. That's at Jimmy's Family Restaurant, 5403 Calhoun Memorial Highway in Easley. Tickets, 50 a single, couple 80. Online ticket sales end the 27th. You can go to the Ducks Unlimited website and get contact information for that. DNR is going to host a series of family fishing clinics around the Midlands. I know that's a stretch for the upstaters, but if you're living down the lower part of this towards the Midlands, November the 1st, Poinsett State Park from 9 to 12, November the 9th, 1:30 to 4:30 at Sesquicentennial State Park, and again, November 15th, 1:30 to 4:30 at Drear Island State Park. These are all free. I would suggest you call the Lorianne Riggin at the Department of Natural Resources, 803-737-8483. Make sure there's still room in these classes, but they're free beginners classes for fishing. The 15th Annual Invitational Barbecue Cook-Off and Festival in the town of Ridgeway, November the 1st and the 2nd, Friday night, no pigs allowed. Well, you know what? I just looked here. It's got November the 1st, the 2nd, 2013. That's not good. Well, we'll skip that one. I'll post something up on the website or the Facebook page if I find a new one. But anyway, not good. I just noticed that. And I just printed it off the other day. Okay, moving along. Historic Camden Revolutionary War site will be the 44th annual reenactment, November the 1st through the 2nd. That's down in Camden, South Carolina. 500 reenactors in a myriad of, you know, period craftsmen, civilian interpreters, lifestyles, and then lots of hands-on activities for kids, lots of military drills, artillery, women in the revolution, a court-martial, pretty cool, tavern tales, lots of stuff to do down in Camden. And then right before I left the house, I found that Fly Fishing Film Night, Highland Brewing Company up in Asheville, going to be put on by Hunter Banks. November the 6th, doors open at 6, films at 7. Really good thing. $15 tickets. I might try to be there. See you on the other side of this break, and we'll get on the Coyotes. Okay, we're back. Again, I kind of rushed through that last one. That's Fly Fishing Film Night, Hunter Banks is sponsoring it up at the Palmetto at the Highland Brewing Company in Asheville. That's put on by Hunter Banks, Southern Culture on the Fly, and the Fiberglass Manifesto. They're going to have a lot of the films that were in the Fly Fishing Film Tour, a lot of the ones that didn't make the finals and that sort of thing from the last few years. So be a good time. Coyotes. I mean, we've all heard them. We've all probably seen them. They're here to stay. Whether you think they were brought in by Department of Natural Resources, fox hunters, whoever, they're here, or just natural expansion because we've removed their predators, the bigger predators. So John Kilgo down at Savannah Riverside that has done a study from 2006 to 9 and 10 to 12. Talked to him this week, recorded a 31-minute interview. We're going to break it up in three parts, but let's get to the first one. And hang with me. There's a lot of good information in here, so listen closely, and we'll be back at the end of the segment. Coyotes. We've all heard them at one time or another. I listened to them behind my house Saturday night and then at the Hunt Club in Lawrence last night. The bottom of a news release from the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources on September the 5th about our 2014 deer harvest, or forecast, gave a mention to a study that was coming out of the Savannah River site in Aiken by USDA Southern Research Station biologist Dr. John Kilgo. There's nothing like getting information from the source, so we're honored to have John on the show with us. John, welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Hey, Roger. Thank you.
Impressive study. You emailed it to me, and in your email you said, this is probably more than you want, but I'll give it all to you, and you can take it from there. But it was a really interesting study. About 27 pages over three papers, all about coyotes and their impacts on our deer harvest, our deer populations. And you are the man that was involved in the studies, and I appreciate you having on. Tell us about coyotes.
All right. Well, the papers that you refer to are some studies that we've done here at Savannah Riverside, and I've been fortunate to have a good team of co-workers helping me out with that. But we started working on this question, I guess, in about the mid-2000s, 2004, 2005.
Okay.
They had shown up at Savannah Riverside in the early 80s, and coyote numbers had increased steadily to the point where we thought something was going on that we needed to take a closer look at.
How did the coyotes get here? I mean, you hear, and we've all heard the stories, the other Department of Natural Resources brought them in, the fox hunters brought them in. We do have legal sale of live coyotes within the state. You confirm that with me. How did they get here?
Coyotes were historically native to the Great Plains.
Right.
As we people started changing the face of the North American landscape by removing wolves, by clearing forests, we made more than just the Great Plains suitable habitat for coyotes, and they started expanding outward. That was 100, 150 years ago.
Okay.
Outward from the Great Plains. So they were moving east. They moved into the northeast and into the southeast, slightly different timelines for their eastward movement. They were coming on their own.
Okay.
Then this question of whether fox hunters brought them into the southeast is well established and well documented. There were legal cases made in a number of states for illegal transport of coyotes into the area, and they were released into the fox running pens and, of course, would inevitably escape from time to time.
Right.
Populations would spring up around these pens where they were released and or escaped and grow from there. They sort of melded with coyotes that were moving eastward on their own. We don't know which natural movement or movement by people was more important. They were coming anyway.
But they were going to get here one way or the other.
Yeah, my feeling is that we may have accelerated the timeline on that, so we've got them now instead of maybe 20, 30, 40 years from now, but they were coming.
Okay. Now, we essentially had two studies, and you and I talked earlier in the week and actually over the past several weeks. And the studies, started about the same time as the Department of Natural Resources was telling us our deer population was too big. Everybody was holding out for them, you know, the 8-point, the 10-point, and letting the does go. And they were urging us to take more does. That's about the same time you said, wait a minute, the coyotes are having an impact here. We need to figure out how much of an impact. Is that right?
Right. We start the deer management community, if you will, deer biologists, had recognized that deer numbers were going up.
Right.
Deer were booming in the 80s and 90s. And it was the general wisdom was we can't shoot enough does to control the population. And so states across the southeast and all up and down the eastern seaboard were liberalizing antlerless tags, encouraging hunters to shoot more does. We've got to do something to control the deer population.
Okay.
What we didn't know at the time and do now is that coyotes were moving in at the same time and starting to have an impact as well. So yeah, that the timing was similar there about when we started this research and as coyotes were starting to become a player in that game.
The 2006 to 2009 study was essentially radio collar and fawns to find out how they were dying. And then the second study from 2010-2012, you did the same radio collaring, same basic steps and all, and you were trying to remove the coyotes and see if you had any increase in fawn recruitment and that sort of thing. So the two studies kind of go hand in hand. We talked about that. But tell us just a little bit about, to lay the groundwork, tell us about the Savannah River site, the study area. Did you use the whole section, or did you pick and choose spots, control areas, and that sort of thing? Just to give us a little background before we get into those studies.
Okay. The main reason we started looking at this was that the deer population at SRS was the various indices of reproduction in the population and the size of the population was starting to trend downward in the late 90s.
Okay.
So much so that in 2000, the deer hunts at SRS were made buck only to protect those, give those a year off to increase reproduction. Then in 2001, after 9/11, the hunts were canceled altogether for security purposes.
I remember
that. So that meant two years in a row that those were completely protected. The population should have doubled with that much protection. It didn't. And so that was the first indication something's going on here. We need to take a look at it. So we started studying coyotes to learn about them. Didn't really know how important they might be, but as part of that study, we looked at what they were eating.
Right.
Discovered that, yes, there are deer remains in their scat, mostly fawns. It's mostly during the spring. We knew that the reproduction in the deer was going down. At the same time, coyotes were going up. So it's starting to come together, but believe it or not, there were a lot of skeptics out there that, you know, the mantra in science is that correlation is not causation. Just because coyotes are coming in and deer are going down doesn't mean there's a cause and effect relationship.
Right.
So we had to do this study that you referred to really settle the issue, and we needed to learn more about the details of it. So that's sort of why we started. And that's the background.
And in these studies, excuse me, you use some really neat devices. And when you read a lot of studies, you don't get the background, and you go into great detail in how you the radio devices and all that you use to know when a fawn gives birth, doe gives birth, know when a fawn dies, all the transmitters and signals that are going through. Give us just a little bit of detail about some of those items that you used without getting too graphic.
The study that we're talking about is about the survival rates of fawns. We wanted to know, we know that coyotes are eating some fawns.
Right.
We know that not that many fawns are living as compared to what used to, but we don't know for sure what's going on. So we need to put radio collars on fawns and see how many of them live, how many of them die.
Right.
And of those that die, why are they dying? Is it coyotes or something else?
Okay.
So the key is catching fawns. Well, fawns are not easy to catch.
They don't
find.
They don't smell. They don't move. They don't do much anything for the first few weeks.
That's right. They just hide. They're extremely well camouflaged, and the numbers of deer are not that great out here anyway. So fortunately, there was a relatively new technology that was coming along right about the time we were starting that involved catching the doe while she's pregnant during the wintertime.
Okay.
Implanting her with a device that is a radio transmitter. It's a vaginal implant transmitter that is expelled when she gives birth. And there's a temperature sensor on that transmitter that detects the change in her body temperature.
Okay.
And the outside ambient temperature. It changes the signal that the radio transmitters emit a beep, a steady beep, and it may be a different pulse rate. It'd be faster or slower,
okay,
or a series of different kinds of beeps. That's what indicated to us that a doe had born when that beep rate changed.
Okay.
I mean, that a doe had given birth.
Okay. And that signaled y'all that it's time to move. And in this study, you talk about how soon you got to those fawns, and sometimes it was within an hour of birth, you were already there.
Right. We had a crew rotating around the clock, checking each doe. And by checking, I mean you would have to get to within a close enough distance to be able to hear that transmitter, which is about a mile.
Okay.
Tune in that frequency and listen to whether it's in normal mode or birth mode.
All right.
And so I had them out there checking every 8 hours around the clock because the doe will move the fawn from where she gives birth within the first few hours. So we had to get there within the first few hours.
Okay.
So the transmitter has a timer on it that tells us it's in half-hour intervals how long it's been.
Okay.
So I would get a call in the middle of the night from one of my crew saying that so-and-so has given birth and it's been 3.5 hours.
Okay.
Or it's been half an hour. Or it's been 8 hours. But that's how we would get there that quickly, and as soon as that call came in.
With John Kilgo. That was the first segment. Sorry about that. Kind of detailed, kind of getting the groundwork laid for it. I guess what you want to take away from the first segment is we can get past the blame game of why coyotes are here. You heard John say, yes, we had cases made where they were bringing them in illegally. But you also heard him said, you know, we removed the predators that preyed on coyotes, so they were coming. We may have just sped it up. So they're here. The double whammy, I remember it. I remember in the late 2000s, mid to late 2000s, where the Department of Natural Resources saying, you know, our deer herd is up over 1 million deer. Y'all need to quit waiting for the trophy buck and start shooting some does because population's too big. We can't support these. And when that finally took hold with hunters, we started doing exactly what they asked us to do. At the same time, the coyotes were taking a very large toll, as they find out, and you'll hear in the second segment of this conversation, on our fawn population, or the recruitment. It is an incredible study. I'll put it up on the Facebook page, and you can go there and link to it and read it. It's pretty detailed, but it's good information, and you'd be amazed at how much trouble they went to get this information. So stay tuned. We'll be back on the other side with the next segment. Welcome back to another segment of Woods and Water, South Carolina. We are listening to a recorded conversation with Dr. John Kilgo from the SRS station down in Aiken, South Carolina, about what essentially is a 7-year study on coyotes. So let's go right back to the next segment and pick up where we left off. And then when you got them, you determine the sex of the fawn, you weighed them. I think in the study you said average handling time was less than 6 minutes, and during that time you radio collared him. Tell us a little bit about the radio collar, because it also functioned to let you know that the fawn was still alive, and then at the time the fawn died for whatever reason, it also gave you a different signal. Is that correct?
That's right. And that was, again, that was the purpose for doing the whole exercise.
Right.
To get that collar on. And let me back up just a second.
Okay.
I should mention that we did give the doe 3 hours. We would wait until it had been at least 3 hours since birth to give her some initial time to bond with the fawn and nurse and groom it and so that it didn't disturb them. And they did not abandon the fawn due to our activity there. That's something you often hear about, but doesn't happen. Anyway, so back to the radio collars.
Yeah.
Yes, they have a motion sensor that determines if the collar has not moved for a period of time, and we had it set at 4 hours, then it changes the beep sequence just like that implant transmitter did.
All right.
And so, again, we're checking these fawns several times a day, listening for that either normal or what we call mortality mode. And if it's in mortality, then, again, we would home in on that transmitter to find whatever we could left of the fawn, if anything was left.
Okay.
And then try to determine why it's not.
Mortality. In the study, you pretty much list them by coyote, bobcats, dogs, and then simply starvation or emaciation, as you put it in there. Tell us a little bit about how you determined exactly how they died.
It's the best thing I can equate it to is the TV show CSI. It's a very meticulous process that we go through when we arrive at the site where we recover the transmitter. We may have to dig it up if it was a coyote that killed it and buried it.
Okay.
Like a dog burying a bone.
Right.
We're looking for any evidence that we can, tracks of the animal, scat of the animal. Sometimes they'll mark it. If it's a bobcat, they'll scratch on a tree. They cache the carcass.
Okay.
Store the carcass in different ways.
All right.
That are distinctive of the predator species.
Okay.
And then sometimes, well, all the time, we would do this, but it was particularly helpful in cases where there was nothing left, that the entire carcass had been consumed, and all we find is a radio collar.
Wow.
Nothing to go on. There's no caching or anything.
Right.
We would collect DNA samples from whatever we had available to us. DNA recovered from any residual saliva that the predator may have left on the carcass or on the collar, submit that sample to a genetics lab, and they could identify not just what species it was, but if there was enough DNA that could be extracted from it, which individual animal it was. So we would identify whether there's a certain animal out there that's killing a lot of the fawns or certain coyote or otherwise.
Did you find out there were maybe one coyote that was having more effect than another one, or was there equal spread across the spectrum?
It does seem that certain individuals do disproportionate amount of the damage, so to speak, but it is spread widely. There are a lot of coyotes out there, and I think they all get their share of it. Yeah, we had a few animals that took several of our fawns.
Okay, so the first study, we're just trying to figure out what effect coyotes are having, and the results, I think, were pretty unexpected, to say the least, maybe.
Right.
What were your predation rates if you took the mortality of the fawns that you found that had died as 100%? What was the predation rate inside that 100% that was dedicated to coyotes?
The coyote predation rate was 62%. There are a lot of different ways to express this, and a lot of different numbers. I'll try to keep this as clear as possible.
And you
did. To answer your question,
the
proportion that coyotes took was 62%. That is 62% of all the radio collared fawns were killed by coyotes.
Wow.
The total mortality, coyotes, bobcats, all other causes combined, was 77%. So that means that 80% of the total mortality is attributable to coyotes. It's easier for us to talk about it in terms of not the mortality rate, but the survival rate, which
right.
is just the opposite. So
right.
77% of them are dying. 23% are surviving.
Which is,
so that was our survival rate, 23%. And that, is, you know, it varies a little bit from year to year.
But that's not a good recruitment rate at all.
That's terrible. Much lower than anybody expected.
So you took those results and you said, we need to do some more work. We need to find out if eliminating or removing coyotes helps that recruitment rate at all. So in 2010, you started essentially the second study with the same groundwork as the first study. In other words, you did the same implanting in the does, the same radio collaring of the fawns, the same determination of, you know, who's killing our fawns and that sort of thing. But this time you added coyote removal. Tell us a little bit about how you went about the process for getting trappers. These were professional trappers, and what they did over that 3-year period.
During the study that we've just been talking about, we were working across the entire SRS, which is a big chunk of ground.
78,000 acres.
Right. I say working, we had fawns radio collared across the area.
Okay.
For this second phase of the second study, we divided the site up into three areas, well, more than that, but we identified three tracts or blocks of 8,000 acres each. And within those, so that's a total of about 24,000.
24.
Mm-hmm. Within each of those, we went in and implemented this coyote removal program, coyote trapping. We hired professional trappers through government contract.
Okay.
To trap during the normal trapping season. In fact, we didn't start them until January. The trapping season begins in December now.
Right.
So it's during the winter prior to the coming fawning season. We had them take out as many coyotes as they could.
Open season.
Those three blocks.
Okay.
And then, like you say, looked at the survival rates in response to see whether it did respond, whether we could increase those survival rates. That's the first thing somebody thinks about. Well, survival is so terribly low, get rid of some coyotes. And so that's what we were trying to see, is whether that would do any good.
In 2010, what were the results?
In 2010, it looked pretty good. So remember that baseline survival rate was 23%.
Right.
We're trying to see if we can get that up. 2010, it was 51%. So we better than doubled it. If we increased it by more than 100%.
Which is better or worse than what you expected?
Well, it was a good start.
Let's
put it that way.
Okay.
But it didn't proceed then. We're going to do this for 3 years. The first year we double our survival rate from where we're starting from.
Okay.
Now let's do it again for a second year.
2011 was?
2011, we got absolutely no benefit from the trapping. The survival rate was 20%, right back where we had started from.
My goodness. And how many coyotes were taken out? There were 474 during the total study, but how many were taken out 2010, 2011? Do you have those numbers?
Yes. So this is all three of those areas combined.
Okay.
So again, this is on 24,000 acres. The first year, it was 169 coyotes total removed. The second year, another 135 removed. And then we did it a third year and took out, again, as many as we did the first year, 168. That totals the 474 figure that you mentioned.
And in 2012, what was your survival rate?
It was sort of intermediate between the first year and the second year, about 43%.
But trapping, professional trapping, is expensive.
It's incredibly expensive, unless you know somebody who you can, you know, work a deal with, like anything else. But generally, it takes a lot of time. The traps are not cheap. It takes a lot of gasoline, driving around, checking your traps every day. It costs a lot of money. It takes a long time.
And coyotes are very smart. I have a friend that lives out in Casper, Wyoming, and one of his jobs is predation control in some of these big ranches out there. And he says that if you fail to get a coyote you know, through one way, through a trap or through a call or something, that that coyote will not fall for that trick again.
Right. I've heard trappers say that. That they are hard to catch. One, some of the hardest animals in North America to trap.
All right. So our expectations were not what we thought they were going to be after removing so many coyotes. What does that mean? Okay, now we're going to boil it down here, and this is where you deer hunters out there need to decide how you're going to approach the coyote problem. Because if you've got a large hunt club or whatever, you might could do some of this trapping. Is that right?
Well, I would think that, a large property, whether it's a club or an individual landowner, larger tracts are going to tend to have more resources to devote to this kind of thing. So, yeah, you would hope. The question as to whether it would do any good, any better on a large tract than a small tract, we don't know. Again, our tract sizes were 8,000 acres each. That's far bigger than the average.
That was just fixing to say that's, yeah, the landowner hunt club is going to be more in the 2,000 or 3,000 acre range.
Right.
And that was the second segment of our conversation. Hang on through the break. We'll be back with the last part.
You know my old car needs washing, and the front yard needs a trim, and the telephone keeps ringing.
Welcome back to the final segment of Woods and Water, South Carolina. Yes, I like Zach Brown. It's quite all right, Dave. It's a good one. And my front yard needs, yeah, cutting grass. Maybe for the last time this year, I hope. We've been listening to a recorded conversation with Dr. John Kilgo from the Savannah River site. He's a USDA biologist, did a study from 2006 to 2009, another one from 2010 to 12 on the effects that coyotes are having on fawn recruitment there at the Savannah River site. Of course, it's going to be different across the state. We've got the final segments, a little over 8 minutes. And we'll wrap this up and come to the end of the show. So here's the final segment of our conversation with John Kilgo. And we shoot, according to the Department of Natural Resources, hunters or whoever out there shoot an estimated 28,000 to 30,000 coyotes a year across the state. That's taking out a large number of coyotes every year. But you were doing the same thing in a controlled environment and saw no benefit. So the coyotes, I mean, you know, we've all heard the den coyotes and that sort of thing, and there's a transient coyote out there that, you know, a lot of us will see during the season. We'll take a shot at him and that sort of thing. But when you luck up and get that transient, you're really not having an effect on the coyotes that are resident in your area because he's just a floater anyway. He's moving from area to area. So what does this say about the coyote deer, I guess, their interaction long-term for deer hunting in South Carolina, deer populations in South Carolina?
Well, if you have the resources to implement an extensive, intensive trapping program, I'm not saying that it won't do any good. The benefits that we saw were modest and much less than we expected, particularly given the number of coyotes that we removed.
Okay.
But it's important to understand the variability that we saw from year to year. There was that second year we saw absolutely no benefit.
Right.
And that the overall average benefit across all 3 years was, like I say, was modest. Does it do any good to shoot one from your deer stand, like you say, that you got the problem with the transient? You mentioned the 30,000 figure statewide that deer hunters shoot.
Right.
That's about 1.5 per square mile. On 8,000 acres, that would come to less than 20. We were taken out, six, seven, eight times that many.
I was just fixing to say a lot more than that.
Combine the fact with that a lot of those are transients with the fact that you're not going to get that many anyway, and that's really a drop in the bucket. Probably not doing much good.
And
the one thing that we can do something about,
okay,
is the number of does that we shoot. We can back off on our antlerless harvest. In contrast to what we deer biologists were preaching 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
If you're on a, and there are still plenty of places that have too many deer.
Right.
But
right.
if you're on a property that doesn't, that seems to have a problem with recruitment of deer, with your overall numbers, that's something that is the easiest thing to control and the most likely to result in an increase in your numbers.
Yeah, because essentially what you're going to do is you're going to have more does producing more fawns to get even a semblance of the recruitment that you're after to begin with.
That's right.
As a byproduct of these studies, you know, where I did a field unit segment down at the Quality Deer Management Association in Athens, and they had a guy from Michigan in there, and he was his whole thing was hinge cutting. And I said, wow, we finally have a redeeming aspect for sweet gum trees, because you can cut them almost all the way off, bend them over, and they still live. So we were real excited. And what he was talking about was bedding areas and that sort of thing. As an afterthought, or maybe something that you're trying to figure out, you know, what we call bedding areas or fawning areas and the habitat. And you were telling me that really you were trying to see if that made a difference, but in the end it doesn't make a difference in fawn survival rate, whether they have the thick cover or the thin cover.
Right. We're hearing more and more about habitat management as a way to improve fawning success, in that if fawns have more cover available to hide in, more of them will survive and get by the coyotes. We were trying to determine if, in fact, those fawns that lived in areas with really thick understory cover had any higher survival probability, any better chance of making it or not. And unfortunately, we didn't see any difference in whether a fawn lived in a wide open pine plantation with nothing but pine straw on the ground versus one that lived in a dense bottom with lots of switch cane and briars and other cover. So I don't want to say that you shouldn't manage habitat and the hinge cutting is bad, but there are other benefits to doing that. But again, I think it's important to understand and to have your expectations tempered by what is probably going to happen. If you're doing that to increase fawn survival, I wouldn't expect any benefit.
So the coyotes are here. They are taking a toll on our recruitment in South Carolina. I think we've seen the first movement towards backing off on our doe harvest with the Department of Natural Resources. Do you have interaction with those guys? Do y'all work together? And do you know if down the road if we're going to see some further pullback on our doe harvest?
I do work with them. In fact, they helped fund a lot of this research. I don't know where that stands and how it differs in the upstate and the low country, but yes, they are well aware of this research and supporting it and taking efforts to do what they can, as far as I understand.
Well, I appreciate it. We bumped schedules for more than 3 or 4 weeks now, and we finally got this together. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate your willingness to talk about it and to put it into terms where the rest of us can understand. Any more studies forthcoming? What's your next avenue, or is this pretty much as far as we're going to take it?
Well, I certainly have a lot of questions yet to study.
Okay.
Getting funding to do that is another matter. Right now we're working on a study that's looking at trying to get a better grip on exactly how many coyotes there are out there. We thought that at the beginning of this we had 4 or 5 per square mile. We took out that many for 3 years in a row, and it was hard to see much of an effect. So there's more out there than we realized. Trying to get a better handle on exactly what that number is what we're working on right now.
Let me ask you something. I've heard this before, and I don't know if it's true, and you may not know either. Are coyotes one of these animals that if they have a lot of pressure, such as intense trapping or something like that, will they reproduce more often than normal?
Not more often. They're unlike dogs. They don't cycle over and over. They come into season once a year.
Okay.
There is some evidence that they can increase their litter size, that a higher proportion of the population will breed, because not all adult females breed every year.
Oh, didn't know that.
So so there are other ways that they can increase their output, their reproductive output, than simply breeding more frequently.
Okay.
I don't think that we're in the situation where we're going to see that in response to trapping or shooting by deer hunters or coyote hunting. That's over large fluctuations in their numbers.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. So all you deer hunters listening out there, you know, you're probably going to have to take a look at what you're seeing from the stand, you know, what you've seen on your trail cams and that sort of thing leading up to the season. But I think all of us need to take a step back and look at our individual population. I know both the places I hunt, you know, I haven't seen many deer at one place. At the farm in Chester, I've seen a lot of does with twins. I haven't heard the coyotes there like I have before. But like I said, I was in Lauren's Hunt Club last night. I saw one doe, and I heard three different groups of coyotes howling after dark. So it's something we're all going to have to think about. John, I appreciate you being on. Appreciate the information. Let's keep in touch, and when you get some of these other studies started, I'd love to talk to you further.
Be happy to.
Thank you very much.
Yes, my pleasure.
Bye. Don't know there's a whole lot more I can add. I hope you listened. If you're a member of a hunt club, I hope you'll talk with your other club mates. I know I've been talking about this study for 3 or 4 weeks now with people that I come in contact with, and you get the varying reactions. Well, you know, I've seen a lot of does with twins and singles. I even seen some triplets this year. And I've heard the other side where, you know, I've seen some does that probably should have had a fawn with them but had nothing. So it's going to boil down to your specific area. You can't do a study and apply it to the whole state, although, you know, our state is mostly, well, I can't say that for sure, but there's a lot of pine trees out there, and you know what I'm talking about. And the predominant tree at Savannah River is pine. I think the brown is down mentality is gone. I hope it is. Brown and down will cause accidents like we've seen. But anyway, I think we're going to have to back off and reevaluate how we approach our own deer herd, because it's going to, you know, you're going to have more does when the coyotes affect your herd just like they affect the Savannah River. I'm going to try to get a hold of Dr. Charles Ruth, who did our study prior to this one and who has been involved in this one. I'm going to try to get him, see if he'll come on, or get somebody to come on and talk about the Department of Natural Resources' reaction to this study, what they're thinking down the road with your tag system. Personally, I'd love to see the check station come back. I mean, I miss the hot dogs that every had he had. So anyway, more on this coming. I hope you listen. I really appreciate him coming on, and I'll publish this somehow or another. I'll try to get it out there if you want to download it, or get John to get it out there to the public. So hey, Chuck Norris. For those of us who live our lives by the clock, Chuck Norris doesn't wear a watch because Chuck decides what time it is. I haven't thought about next week because we started cooking a pig at 5:30 this morning, and right about now 168 pounds of pork is coming off the smoker at my brother's house. And with my mind, that's about as far as it would go, food. We did one of these last year for Dad's 80th birthday, and it was so much fun, we kind of made it an annual event. The smoker, if you will, is pretty simple, except for the big steel grate, not very expensive. I'll put a few pictures up next week on Facebook so you can see it for yourself. It's a combination of 36 concrete blocks stacked up for the sides, a couple of 8-foot 2x12s cut to form a kind of a heat box around the grate, a piece of plywood for a top, a thermometer for the air temp inside, and one for the pig. Couple of pieces of plywood to cover the open ends of the concrete block sides. Pictures will be free, but the 8-page engineered drawings from Dad will cost you plenty. I'll bring Dave some this week, and he can tell you if it works or not. Good, sound good to you, Dave? Okay. If you decide to build one of your own, don't forget to season the grate before you cook your first pig. There's James. So that's another edition of Woods and Water, South Carolina. I'm going to pick a pig with my family and friends. Probably eat way too much. Try to get out and see the leaves. Be careful on those roads. Remember, get your chewing gum. Don't forget to take plenty of pictures with the camera that you remembered to bring. See you next week.